Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I recorded this interview with Elizabeth Fernandez of Movement Voter Project before the death of George Floyd or the subsequent protests. But rest assured that MVP supports many local groups currently working against racism and for redefining the role and practices of the police.
Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Elizabeth Fernandez. She's Communications Director of Movement Voter Project, which helps progressive donors to support the best local community-based organizations in key states. And you can learn more at movement.vote, movement.vote. And for those of you who didn't know there was a domain called vote, I guess there is. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. There are 167 days until Election Day, and I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans get their right to vote. This is even more challenging in this time of pandemic. Make sure that all Americans can vote by mail and learn about the need to fund the U.S. Postal Service that's been hit hard by the loss of business mail. We'll talk much more about the campaign with today's guests. And as we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation now unfolding. And now to today's conversation. We know that the 2018 midterm election saw the Democrats take over the House and win a lot of races in state houses across the country. And one organization whose strategy contributed is Movement Voter Project, a tool that helps progressive donors find the best grassroots vote groups you've never heard of in all 50 states, but especially in key states like Florida and Ohio. And they develop a peer-to-peer campaign to shift money from the tried-and-true beltway strategy of high-priced consultants and big TV ad buys to local groups doing grassroots work in the communities. Since 2016, they've helped more than 3,000 donors, large and small, move $18 million to more than 350 organizations working on elections in 42 states, including every competitive Senate and gubernatorial race and 81 House races. And my guest today is their communications director, Elizabeth Fernandez, and we're going to talk about how they came up with their approach, what they accomplished in 2018, what they learned, and what they're up to in 2020. Born and raised in South Florida to immigrant parents, Elizabeth Fernandez has worked with broad coalitions of nonprofits and community groups on voter education and Get Out the Vote campaigns. She's led online mobilization efforts that have garnered worldwide attention. She's helped register thousands of new voters while serving on the board of Engage Miami, a nonprofit dedicated to youth civic engagement. She previously served as communications manager for Florida Immigrant Coalition, communications director of SEIU, Florida, and managing editor of Miami's The New Tropic. Welcome, Elizabeth Fernandez, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you so much. It is a great pleasure to be here.
Okay, and let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, May 19th, and that's how I came up with that 167 days till the election. First of all, how are you doing? Where do you live? What's the pandemic like where you are? How are you coping, etc.?
Yeah, well, I'm in Orlando, Florida, and my parents are in South Florida. So, you know, we've definitely been hit in Florida, especially in South Florida in particular. It has been unsettling to see Governor DeSantis really roll back things at the whim of Donald Trump in a lot of ways. And so just concerned about my family. My wife and I probably both had a coronavirus early in March. I remember the first day that my wife got a fever, they'd only tested 10,000 people in the entire country. And it was just the idea of trying to get a test was completely impossible, but we were both very sick for 3 weeks. There were definitely some points where we thought we would have to go to the hospital because it was really rough. And we had a mild case. I think that's one of the things that is so upsetting, is even a mild case just completely knocks you out. So, you know, we're getting through, but thankfully we're both okay on the other side, and I'm just really, really grateful and of course very concerned, especially for all of my family in South Florida.
Yeah. Oh, Florida has definitely been in the news, as it always seems to be when it comes to politics. I grew up in Florida myself. I did first grade in Miami, moved to Jacksonville in sixth grade, and graduated from Cocoa High in Cocoa, Florida, back in 1965.
But, oh, yeah. No, that's not too far.
Yeah, no, Orlando.
I was born and raised in Hollywood before moving to Miami.
Yeah, and Orlando was actually the big city if you lived in Cocoa, and that was before Disney World, when Orlando was much smaller, but it was still our big city. To make that trip was, like, really cool. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, so let us know a bit about yourself. Briefly, how do you see your path to the work that you do today? And you can go way back, you know, a moment of inspiration as a child, a mentor, a turning point, that sort of thing.
Well, I was born in Hollywood, Florida, 30 minutes from Miami in 1980. And that is the year that Miami had, at that point, the worst riots in history, related to a really brutal incident of police brutality. It was a time where there was a lot of struggle, a lot of injustice. The drug wars were really devastating South Florida, and a lot of people were coming because of some of the really brutal policies that the United States had implemented across the country when it comes to Latin America. So that was where I grew up. And I grew up with immigrant parents who basically went from being college professors to my father working at 7-Eleven, my mother working as a janitor in a hospital.
And they had both been college professors in what country?
Yeah, in Colombia.
Uh-huh.
And seeing that kind of struggle, you know, seeing my mother in particular, my parents divorced when I was very, very young, and seeing my mother struggle to raise us, struggle to learn English, struggle and work her way up to becoming a social worker, and always dedicating herself, even with all the struggles she had, to helping others. I grew up hearing her stories of marching through the streets in Colombia and running away from tanks that were just mowing down protesters, and just really hearing her stories of revolution. And they definitely inspired me, especially growing up at a time period in South Florida where there was injustice and struggle everywhere. And then really seeing the place where I grew up blossom into this internationally renowned city of extravagance and brutal injustice still, and seeing the real dramatic racism and disparities in that place. And I have been volunteering, working, fighting to make the world a better place constantly. And part of that is I've been really involved in LGBTQ rights. I worked for many years with Women in Distress, which is a domestic violence organization in South Florida, supporting immigrant rights and civic engagement overall. And it really led me to leaving a private sector career where I was working in publishing and just basically saying, okay, now is the time. This was in 2015 or so, where I basically said, okay, I've been doing this on the side long enough. I have been doing this amazing work while also working full-time in publishing, and just said, I want to dive in. And I have since worked with Service Employees International Union and did a lot of labor work. I was running communications in Florida for the largest canvassing operation in the state, which that should have been Hillary Clinton running that operation. That should have been.
Oh, right, right.
But it was a group of nonprofits and C3s and C4s working with SEIU to form a committee to really try to a coalition to really try to change everything from the grassroots up. And we've had some amazing successes, especially on a real local level. We've had some just devastating losses that have been so close it breaks your heart. I was really heavily involved in 2018 as well. I was with the Florida Immigrant Coalition at the time, and you know, seeing the elections be so brutally close, and seeing the hundreds of thousands of people that were removed from the voter rolls, and knowing after 2016 that things were going to get really bad, and then working with Florida Immigrant Coalition and seeing in particular how our immigrant communities were absolutely devastated. I mean, things people don't seem to understand. You know, Donald Trump tweeted that ICE was going to be, you know, here are these cities where ICE this weekend is going to do all of these raids. And Miami is on the list of those cities. I mean, in immigrant communities, I would go to local businesses where the shops would normally be full in these vibrant immigrant communities. For the next 2 weeks, there was nobody at the stores. It was a ghost town. People are too afraid to go out.
And this is, let me just set the context. This is in the hot part of the electoral campaign.
Now, this was after Trump won during 2018 election period.
Oh, in the 2018 electoral period. Okay, of course.
In 2018 electoral period, where Trump was really, really brutalizing immigrant communities, really using immigrant communities as just his punching bag in every single way. He sends out a tweet saying, hey, ICE, you need to go raid these cities. And those cities are devastated. The immigrant communities are terrified. Our immigrant hotline was just getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calls constantly, thousands of calls in a weekend of just people, can I take my child to school? Can I go to the doctor? I can't go to work because ICE is about to raid our neighborhoods. I mean, the real devastation that our immigrant communities in particular have suffered is heartbreaking and enraging. And I was really heavily involved in a lot of the efforts to close these horrible detention camps. You know, I was really involved in doing communications alongside the coalition that helped shut down the Homestead Children's Detention Center. And that was just a year straight of campaigning and going there and somehow getting the primary candidates. If you remember, they all somehow showed up. We got them to show up in Homestead.
Yeah.
Where they just looked over a fence and they could see these poor children in detention. And history is going to look back on what's happening right now and just be horrified. And so along the way, I found myself in this position where my background is 100% grassroots. In fact, Florida Immigrant Coalition is one of the organizations that Movement Voter Project has funded in Florida for years. And so I come into this work with the lens and the perspective of somebody who did not grow up with a lot of privilege, as somebody who could never imagine having the amount of money that any of our donors or funders have.
Right.
But seeing what difference it makes on the ground, seeing what difference it makes to say, we have the funding to launch a campaign that's going to help get somebody out of detention. We have the funding to launch a campaign that's going to help shut down an entire detention center. And seeing not just the changes, the electoral victories, which are amazing and really amazing. In 2018, my state rep right now is Anna Eskamani, who is the first Iranian-American elected to office anywhere in Florida. And she has been an absolute warrior fighting for not just her community, but all vulnerable communities in Florida. And part of the reason why she was elected was because grassroots groups in Florida, in Central Florida, turned out communities that don't normally show up during a midterm election, and they voted for this amazing candidate.
I would think that one of the things that happened in 2018 is that because neither side usually votes heavily, Republicans vote more heavily than Democrats, but neither side votes like they do in a general election with a presidential ticket at the top. It means that if you can mobilize, if you can raise the numbers, you've got a pretty good chance of making a difference.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is really powerful about what Movement Voter Project is doing, frankly. In any election, we actually have the numbers to win if you really think about progressive blocs.
As someone who's worked for people's rights on the ground, grassroots, and so on, why have you personally chosen to focus your activism on electoral politics? There are some who would say, you know, that's that both parties are compromised. It's there's gridlock. It's not going to make a difference. I'm going to work at the local level and so on. But you have chosen, in working with Movement Voter Project, to focus on electoral politics and even national electoral politics. What goes into that choice for you?
All electoral politics are local. I get just as excited about a race for somebody who's running for city commission as I get over somebody who's running for president. I get way more excited. Here's the thing. I have seen just personally what a tremendous difference electoral politics makes down ballot. And that's a place that is frequently ignored because people follow whatever shiny candidate it is. But here's the thing, grassroots groups in particular, they're not there for the president. They're there for the campaigns that are actually going to make a difference. And that can be state rep, that can be the local county commissioner, the local city commissioner. And in turning that out, it can change presidential races. It has, and it will change presidential races. But my focus is on what our communities need, and it always has been. And it's that sort of thing where for me, I always, from very early on, saw the connection between all of those things. The first time I went canvassing was for Al Gore in 1998 or something. And I've been able to see what the sad truth is, that the party has completely ignored so much of down ballot for such a long time in a way that the Republicans have not. The Republican Party has not ignored that. That's why they've been able to pack everything in our state legislatures against real progress.
Right. And as we know, in certain states, I don't know how much it's true in Florida, but in many states, the Republican Party has through gerrymandering and other things, managed to basically bring forward minority rule, where in an election they might lose 60-40 in terms of the popular vote and still win the majority in the state legislature. And this is true time mm-hmm. and again. And it's because, as we've pointed out on this show many times, that in 2010, and we're talking about, you know, 2 years into the Obama administration, the Democratic Party, it seemed, made no real effort to win those 2010 elections. And the Republicans, knowing that if you only do the redistricting every 10 years, that means once every 20 years, it will not coincide with the presidential election. In other words, mm-hmm. we have one of those elections this time, but it does coincide with the presidential election. But in 2010, it did not. And the number of states where the Republicans won the legislative victories that allowed them to redistrict those states and ensure their control, I think so much of everything we look at since 2010 goes back to that set of decisions by those two parties. Let me ask you a question about the parties, by the way, Elizabeth, which is, mm-hmm. Are Movement Voter Project's electoral choices, the people they choose to support, the candidates they choose to support, determined by strictly by policy or goal choices, or are you partisan? In other words, can a progressive independent or a progressive green or a progressive Republican get the support of Movement Voter Project, or is it always going to be supporting Democrats?
Well, here is, for me, the beauty of Movement Voter Project, and one of the reasons that I think it's such a powerful and unique organization. We don't support candidates at all. We don't function as a PAC in that sort of way. It's almost the opposite. We trust and grow the grassroots. So if a grassroots organization says that we think is going to do an amazing job turning out the vote in their communities and defending their communities, if they say that they're going to, for example, in a primary race, okay, we had candidates, we had organizations that we supported who were, we're going to support Bernie Sanders. We're going to support Elizabeth Warren. We're going to support whoever. We don't tell them who to support at all. We listen to what's happening on the ground. We listen to the grassroots, and we let the grassroots grow.
Very good.
And
so, in other words, when I said, is it based on policy or goals, it's based on policy and goals, but even more, it's based on the groups that pursue those policies and goals, the groups that speak for those communities. And if you empower them in their electoral strategies and their get out the votes and so on, that's that. So I get what you're saying. You're like one step removed from partisanship because you're choosing groups that work for the goals you have in mind.
We trust the grassroots to know, because they're the ones living and breathing in their community. And that's one of the biggest issues with parties in general, political parties in general, and the Democratic Party in particular, because there are amazing Democrats out there. But in any sort of election, you get a wave where basically everyone shows up for 3 months and then they disappear. Everyone shows up for 6 months if it's a presidential election and then they disappear. My background is I lived and breathed the grassroots where, okay, these candidates disappear, but our people still need help. Our people still need to know, hey, they're up for a representative race, and I don't even know who this is. There's a sheriff's there is a sheriff's race coming up, and this is the person who's going to lock up our brothers and sisters. We don't know anything about that. Oh, you know what? We're going to band together and work with some of the other grassroots groups. Here's a forum so you can meet the sheriffs that are running. Here's a forum so you can meet the people who are running for your local city council and county council. And we really need to listen to what's happening on the community level. And that is actually having major, tremendous impact. It's a really long chain from the people who are going to vote in a presidential election. And then for them to understand how all of these other candidates that are running, who may or may not have any party support, who may even be nonpartisan, but have a tremendous impact on people's lives.
Very good. Okay, this. Yeah, you've sort of filled in the picture for me. In other words, I kind of knew from the 10,000 foot view what your strategy was, but I see how you're saying that it's interesting. Your niche is somewhere much closer to the grassroots, and yet if you reach out to, say, donors, wealthy donors, it's to bring them in contact with the grassroots. And so, okay, let me just tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Fernandez. She's Communications Director of Movement Voter Project, this innovative organization which helps progressive donors to support the best local community-based organizations in key states. And you can learn more at movement.vote, movement.vote.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I recorded this interview with Elizabeth Fernandez of Movement Voter Project before the death of George Floyd or the subsequent protests. But rest assured that MVP supports many local groups currently working against racism and for the redefinition of the role and practices of the police.
So, you've actually done a good job of a question I was about to ask, which is, what is the problem that Movement Voter Project is responding to? And you've said it's as much as anything else, it's this top-down way of running campaigns, and it's the fact that if all you're oriented toward is elections, you come in, as you say, a few months before an election, a year before an election, you have a presence, you do something, and then you leave. And so that's sort of the situation that Movement Voter Project is responding to. Let me ask you, the sort of the three questions that if I were the consultant to your organization, I would ask, which are, what are your goals? What are your strategies? And then we can get into your 2020 tactics in more detail. But what are the goals of Movement Voter Project, and what are the strategies you use to implement them?
Really, our overarching goal is to win a progressive decade. That is our big goal. Every single thing that we do up and down the ballot, the groups that we support, when we make our decisions, is this going to get us toward the progressive future, the progressive decade that we need? We already see through this pandemic how bad things can get with the wrong people in office. Now imagine that multiplied a thousandfold when you have coastal communities that are getting flooded in the next 10 years, when you have wildfires that are just destroying entire cities. If we don't have the right elected officials in place to actually give us a progressive future, I don't know how this country survives. I don't know how this world survives.
Okay, so a progressive decade. I like that. So in other words, here we sit in 2020. Your goal, your vision is at least out at 2030.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay. If we're talking about tactics.
What?
If we want to talk.
Well, first, strategies. Yeah, so you have developed
have
a set of strategies
we're trying to, do,
to do that. And what are those strategies that really, as I see it, don't exist in that many other organizations or that many other things that we can put our finger on in this election year? So what are your strategies to achieve those goals?
So for us, what we are really trying to focus on is raising $500 million to $100 million to support the best grassroots local organizing groups working in key states. And we have state advisors on the ground who are themselves powerful organizers who know the states up and down, know the organizations who are actually, and it's not just, we don't just provide money. When we fundraise, we provide money, but then we also build capacity. And mm-hmm. that can mean everything from actually having training sessions, having our own state advisors act as consultants to make sure that the organizations are healthy, that people are really not just being taken care of, but that they're also empowered to grow and change and have true leadership. That can be everything from supporting groups that are, you know, you'll have in every state, you will have these anchor organizations that have been doing the work that are amazing. They have a giant statewide presence. You'll have emerging groups that are literally just, we're three people and we want to do something amazing. And you know what? We think it's going to be amazing. So how can we support you and make this amazing, innovative thing happen that may not be being done anywhere else? And then all the groups in between, you know, that are organizing in a city, in a neighborhood, and all together, we really are reaching in particular, because we focus especially on communities of color, supporting communities of color. And, you know, the truth is, when you have organizations and nonprofits that are led by people of color, they actually have a much harder time getting funding. Well, we fund predominantly mm-hmm. organizations worked and led by people of color, and as well as LGBTQ individuals, as well as Native American groups. We really are trying to fund the people who are underfunded in when it comes to more traditional funding methods, because they're doing the work in the communities that need it the most.
And so are you at work, in other words, there'll be an election on November 3rd. Is Movement Voter Project going to be at work the rest of November? Is Movement Voter Project going to be at work in January 2021?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have cycle goals every cycle, and we're very close to meeting our $50 million cycle goal and then raising it to our next step, which is $100 million. We want to be honest. We think the need is closer to $600 million. We work with other funders. And one of the things that we also do is make sure that on off-cycle years, these organizations continue to be funded. Because what ends up happening is you have an amazing organizer. They're just getting started, or even maybe midway through their career, they are in this group. They have learned so much. They have made so many community connections. That's the other issue with organizers. It's about making those communities. All of a sudden, if the funding for that group disappears in November and they are unable to function, or they have to fire half their staff, then all of the work is lost. And it's that same thing that you get from political parties top down. You get a wave, the election's over, okay, goodbye. No. We need to make sure, for example, that during the next midterm, we are going to defeat Trump. If we do what we need to do, and I don't just mean a Movement Voter Project, right, but as a country, okay?
Yes.
If and when we finally get Trump out of office, just as a society here, then we need to start focusing on the elections, the midterms. We need to immediately start focusing on that, because we also saw what happened to Obama, right? If we're thinking about 2010, a Republican takeover, you know, let me just give you a little bit of a regional example about from the Midwest. And I want to take you through a little bit of a timeline.
Great.
So in the Midwest, in 2006, they started instituting voter ID laws, which disproportionately impact people of color and vulnerable communities. Then 2008, you have it's major financial crisis. But by 2009, the Tea Party starts rising. The Republican takes over the Midwest, really, when it comes to the state legislatures and the governorships in 2010. And then in 2011, they have gerrymandered Midwest states in particular to the extreme. In 2012, they started stripping, they implemented right to work laws, stripping all the power from the labor movement. And considering the fact that in the Midwest and states like Wisconsin, for example, they used to be progressive testing grounds where they would test some of these amazing policies that would get instituted across the country. Well, that's since 2012, and they instituted right to work laws in states across the Midwest, stripping labor from having power, from having members, implementing austerity measures, increasing voter suppression tactics, totally broke public sector unions. Meanwhile, the Democrats are not investing in any sort of progressive infrastructure in the area, which leaves the area totally ripe for these culture wars, for this real right-wing grassroots movement to build up. And then all of a sudden, Trump wins the Midwest, wins all of these states that people are like, oh, a Democrat hasn't lost these in, you know, decades. But if you look back, this started in 2006.
Absolutely. By the way, let me cut in, because that is one of the things that made me crazy. When we all heard that Wisconsin had been taken by Trump with a small number of voters, it was a very small win. And then you hear, I believe, that the Clinton campaign had no appearances by the candidate in Wisconsin. It wasn't like Scott Walker hadn't happened. It wasn't like like Wisconsin was Wisconsin of 1950 or 1954. Wisconsin had gone through this radical change. It seems to me that would have been, you know, put a pin in Wisconsin. That's crucial. So, I mean, it's just crazy. But that's what your timeline sort of is demonstrating. Okay, go ahead.
Well, so speaking of Wisconsin, okay, let me give you some numbers here. So the margin in Wisconsin, 22,000 votes. Mm. That's what won Trump. Okay, Trump won Wisconsin by 22,748 votes. And so now look at this. This is the people, the number of people of color who did not vote in 2016. Are you ready for this? 327,000.
Now wait, that's who didn't vote in 2016, who had voted in the Obama elections previously?
Just who had the ability to vote and did not.
Oh, okay. 357,000.
327,000 people of color did not vote in that election. But let me tell you, the turnout for among people of color in Wisconsin was really dramatic. I actually have some of those numbers, and they're just like, whew. In the Midwest states in particular, those numbers were really dramatic when you saw the real drop, especially in Black voters. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing where we can win. We really, really can do this. It's just we need to invest, okay, in the organizations that are led by and for people of color to get people educated. And that's where all of these midterm elections, all of these smaller local elections are so important. Not just because obviously the candidates are important, changing a local community is important, but because voting is a muscle and you need to exercise it.
Yeah.
And that is so true. So
one thing I hadn't thought of before in terms of what we're talking about, but it actually is just an added fact, is that so many of those voter suppression tactics that have been put into place will drop you from the rolls if you don't vote. Mm-hmm, so getting people to vote means that it beats their voter suppression tactic, because now they're not on the list that gets that postcard that makes it easy for them to lose their ability to vote. Let me
Absolutely.
Ask you, if you will, because we've got about 15 more minutes. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of your examples of successes. In 2016, New Hampshire, for instance, in 2019, Virginia, and some others like that, so that people get a sense of that this isn't just a theory, that it actually makes a big difference.
So it definitely not just a theory. So in Alabama, you know, when we're talking about Doug Jones, African-American voters, that's what was all over the media, that they were not energized. They were not excited to vote in the Senate race. And yet on December 12, 2017, Black turnout was actually through the roof. It surpassed white turnout. And that was because of the amazing work of organizations like Black Voters Matter and Woke Vote that literally said, we are going to focus on Black turnout. This is the Black Belt. We're going to turn out our folks. We are going to make sure that our people know to vote in this super weird special election. Like voting is a muscle that you have to exercise. Having an election on December 12th is not a muscle that people normally exercise. So you really need to get knocking on doors. You really need to be making the phone calls. You need to be talking to the community to even let them know and educate them that these things are happening and how they can participate. But not just that, you know, the motto of Black Voters Matter is it's about us. It's we're voting for us. We're not even the and that's one of the things that people are very nervous about. Frankly, when it comes to Biden, is people aren't excited. Well, people need to be excited to vote for themselves. Me voting is voting for me. I'm voting for myself. I'm voting for the future that I want. And that's something that can really, really win, even when you have a candidate that a community isn't necessarily excited about. Now, if we want to talk about real victories, something that's extremely relevant right now is Wisconsin, because we have been funding groups in Wisconsin for years, and some just absolutely powerful, amazing groups like Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, Leaders Igniting Transformation, Voces de la Frontera, Freedom Action Now. These are organizations in Wisconsin that we have helped fund, that in some instances we have helped launch, that are doing amazing work, and not just on an electoral level, you know, because these organizations will launch mutual aid funds, they will help train youth to become leaders, and at the same time, they're organizing people to actually show up and vote, and training them to train others.
And so, and was this did this play a role in the recent Supreme Court upset in Wisconsin?
Oh yes, they were very, very heavily involved in that. In fact, if you go through some of the timeline, so some of those groups that I just mentioned were part of the March 18th lawsuit and letter to election officials. Mm-hmm. To actually try to postpone the election. And then Governor Evers launched the Safer at Home on March 24th. By March 31st, polling sites started to close. Can you believe in Milwaukee they had 5 polling sites?
I know.
A city as big as Milwaukee. By April 22nd, the judge extended the absentee mailing. That's a direct tie-in to some of the organizations I just mentioned that launched that lawsuit. And then can you just imagine, you're an organizer on the ground trying to let your community know what's happening. On April 6th, the governor postpones the election. That happens in the afternoon. By the evening, the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the Supreme Court of the United States overruled the postponement.
Right.
So these organizations were literally making phone calls, sending hundreds of thousands of texts, literally working just to even let
right. In other words, one of the things that will hurt voter turnout is confusion. And so in this case, the confusion is not just someone putting out misinformation. It's, is the election on? Is it on today? Is it on next week? And so on. And you've got to be nimble and large enough that you can actually act in those kind of situations. And obviously that was victorious. I am going to, from my notes, mention some of the successes that have grown out of your work. In 2016 in New Hampshire, Movement Voter Project moved $188,000. Now, this is a small state. They contacted 85,000 voters, and Maggie Hassan won her Senate seat by 1,027 votes. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's New Hampshire 2016. Virginia 2019. This is where Virginia, for the first time in I don't know how long, but I mean, I know there was a past that was very Democratic, but then after the civil rights movement and so on, Virginia's been a red and then purple and so on. But in 2019, the Democratic Party won the governorship in both houses. And the policies that have come out of that include Election Day is now a state holiday, automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration, prohibit health insurance providers from discrimination based on gender identity or transgender status, increase Virginia's minimum wage by 30%, allow undocumented and refugee college students to pay in-state tuition, establish the Virginia Environmental Justice Act. All of that happens because Virginia changed not in nationally, not for president, but because it changed locally. And also exactly. In 2018, you your backed candidates, or the candidates backed by the grassroots organizations you supported, won the 2018 seven governor's races, 350 legislative seats, six new states where the Democratic Party controls the governor in both legislative chambers, and four states where Republicans had had that before, governorship and both legislative chambers were broken. Also, ballot measures like the felonies regaining their right to vote in Florida, which could mean up to 1.4 million formerly incarcerated Floridians will now be able to exercise their right to vote, which it seems to me is one of the reasons that you are choosing Florida as one of your swing states. And now we're going to switch to 2020. In 2020, you say five states will decide 2020. Wisconsin, yeah. Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Florida. And the reason that I said that way is that Arizona and Florida were not, I don't think, at the top in 2016. Why Arizona and Florida?
So Arizona in particular, we have seen some amazing shifts and actual statewide victories as well, you know, winning Senate seats and other Senate seats that are very competitive, presidential seats that are very competitive. And Arizona is one of those places where, frankly, the Democratic Party has not invested much historically, but it is a place where we really, really think we can win. If we're talking about Arizona, the 2016 margin, it was 91,000 people. Mm. So it wasn't a huge margin for the size of the state. So Arizona is a place that has historically low turnout among people of color compared to some of the other states. And, you know, this is the thing. In 2016, 806,000 people of color did not vote. 723,000 youth did not vote in 2016. Compare that to the margin of victory. We have been supporting Native American organizing, Latinx organizing, Black organizing, and not just in the cities either. We've been really supporting rural organizing in Arizona, you know, organizations like Lucha, Poder en Action, Our Voz, Our Vote. You know, there are organizations that are actually a lot of emerging organizations too that we've also helped fund in Arizona. I think that we have more than enough numbers and more than enough infrastructure, progressive grassroots infrastructure organized by the people of Arizona for the people of Arizona to really get us to victory or to get us close to victory. And here's where the pandemic changes everything.
Right.
We need to have backup states, and I very firmly believe we can win the Midwest, but as they've been using Wisconsin as a conservative proving ground, you see what they've done. What they did during the primary election in Wisconsin, which, you know, by the way, we're almost every candidate that our groups backed won. So we can show that we're nimble enough. Like, the groups that we support they're willing to sacrifice so much, and they're so amazing and powerful in what they're doing for their communities, that even facing every single thing that the really brutal state GOP led legislature can throw at them. And here's the thing, we're going to be facing that in, I think, every single state where we have GOP legislature. We're going to see those kinds of efforts up and down the states. Every single thing that they can do to make sure that people are going to have to risk their health to vote, to make sure that people are going to have vote by mail become an increasingly harder and harder.
Let me ask you this, Elizabeth. We've got about 2 minutes left. If someone is with you and they back the electoral choices that you back, and they want to maximize the chances of success, specifically in the current conditions of the pandemic and so on and so on, what should listeners do? Both in terms of Movement Voter Project and in terms of kind of the bigger picture of the way you see things, even if they don't work through Movement Voter Project. What should listeners and voters do?
So I think we need to do everything we can to protect against voter suppression. We need to make sure that vote by mail is a real and valid option in as many states as possible. All of the big five states actually have vote by mail. So we're going to need a lot of volunteer work and a lot of organizers that can help do what we call ballot chase work, making sure that people know how to request an absentee ballot, make sure that people know how to send their ballot through vote by mail, and we're making sure that they send it on time, because each one of those states also has a different rule for when the ballot needs to arrive. So that is some of the most powerful work that people can do. Please go to movement.vote. You can find out so many different organizations that you can donate to. We actually don't get a cut. All of the donations to Movement Voter Project groups go straight to the groups, straight to them. And I will also say, if you want to get involved, you can go to movement.vote, look up a state, and find some of the groups in your state. See how you can volunteer. We need people to donate and give with their hearts if they can. But we also need people to sign up to be a volunteer, sign up to volunteer, make phone calls, sign up to text bank. If you go to movement.vote, we actually have organizations from all of the states. You can just find the website of whatever organization you want to volunteer with. And it's, you know, a lot of them are led by people of color. The vast majority, we've got LGBTQ organizations, we've got Native American organizations, Muslim organizations, whatever your heart tells you to give, please do, and also give of your time, because all need to be in this together.
Yeah, one thing I see there is that you can work specifically through movement.vote, through the Movement Voter Project, to actually move funds around that you were going to give maybe to the place you've been giving them, and now you're going to, instead of giving them to some national organization, you're going to give them on a more local basis. But what I also hear is that by going to your site and then going to the person's own state, they can learn the organizations that you have vetted that both are going to be good on getting out the vote and electoral action, but that they're good on the ground all the time. And so a place to find effective organizations, progressive organizations in your state to back, you can use your site to do that as well.
Absolutely. Like, let's say I go to movement.vote and I just go to browse all groups. I'm in Florida. I look up Florida. Here are 23 groups in Florida where I can just go on a website and start volunteering right now.
Wonderful. Where, you know, so you can fund them. You can volunteer. Yeah. You can spread the word. I think this is excellent. I hadn't even really thought about that piece of what you're doing. We've got to bring the conversation to the close. So let me tell people again, you can learn more and now much more. You can learn more and get involved either as a donor or as a volunteer in your local state, in your local community, by going to movement.vote, movement.vote. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or a world that just might work, all one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles that I'll choose to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com, mac, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, at most major podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at Apple Podcasts. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. And thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Let more people know about the work of the Movement Voter Project and get involved. And finally, thank you, Elizabeth Fernandez. Keep up the good work.